September 19th, 2008, is the Watt from Pedro Show. from Pedro show. That was John Coltrane with Naima, the fifth take, alternate take. And then we heard Hitamari by Black Moth Super Rainbow. And we're in the Czech Republic in the big town Prague.
Yeah.
Stooges sax man Steve McKay with me, and we have special guests. Yarda Sidaivi, otherwise known as Arno.
Thank you.
And
yes,
he's come to share some life.
Yes.
Of music.
Of music and fun and...
spent some time with the Plastic People of the Universe, but...
At the time, I was doing another band. They started being really... big. Some of the members of the Primitives group become a members of the Plastic People.
Okay.
Which, you know, they were oriented more in a different music. And in that time, you know, I was doing not the pop, because, you know, I never like really a pop. But I think the thing it was that I was becoming the space cadet, you could say. We started, I have to tell you the story, we were talking earlier, so let's go back to the...
Let's go back to the music. How did you get into music?
That's interesting story. I was madly in love with rock and roll soon as I heard Little Richard and Fats Domino and Elvis Presley, and you know, soon I heard King, and all these other, you know, everybody, you name it, of course, you know,
old like rock and roll,
old rock and roll. I mean, you know, it was like, okay, what did I want it to be before? Well, skip all that. I want to get into rock and roll. Now, what can I do? How can I get into the rock and roll? So, you get some connections that you probably... Because I know the one thing in that time, there was a rock and roll bands already playing in Prague. So, you know, there was...
What time is this about?
This, you talking like 1962.
And how old are you then?
How old was I? Well, now I'm 60, so that was a long time ago.
But you weren't playing anything before that.
It's like, 48 or so. I mean, you know, no, absolutely nothing. You know, this is my old build-up in the head that, you know, how to get into the rock and roll.
Right.
So I thought, I went to the different bands. I madly was in a band that was called Hell's Devils, which it was a really something very strange, but very original and very rock and roll. I mean, Hell's Devils was really, really, really good band.
Prague band.
Very Prague band and very underground band, because whenever they play it, everything was destroyed. I mean, everything was destroyed. They took down the Lenin statues, you know, and you know, it's like mostly you were playing in a places which it was like this conference hall for the streets, you know, like let's say like 10 blocks had like a one place that it was and public place, like a social club or something like that. You know, once a month they all from these 10 blocks or, you know, 12 blocks around, they gather in that in place. And there were always some commies people, you know, they're talking, you know, how they have to make better the neighborhood and all that, you know, and who doesn't bad, you know, who does bad and things, you know, and who should take care of his son that he's, you know, not good and blah, blah.
Yeah.
I mean, really brainwashed kind of situation. But anyway.
There's also gigs there.
In these places, you had PA.
Ah.
So, if you had a band, you play in a places like this. Because, you know, there were no other places. I mean, there were like a dance places, but those people, they were doing, sometime they were doing rock and roll, but not so many. Only because the kids but like so rowdy that, you know, they said, no, we can't really permit this. So, you know, it was, but anyway, I knew that there were an absolute need for the rehearsing for the bands. And because I knew through my place that I know actually, you know, one of those places with the gathering place, right? The social club, so call it, you know, which it was like a headquarters of commies, you know, I mean, for the block center, you know, whatever you call it. So I get this band. I went to the manager, who later on actually become the manager of the Primitive group. And I went after him, you know, I told him, look, what does it take the guy like me to work for the rock and roll band like this? And he said, well, I tell you what, you get us a rehearsal place and you're going to be a roadie for the band. So I told him that I get the place. So I got the place and I got the actually the roadie gig. So when I was doing the roadie, the drummer of that band, you know, because, you know, I was bashing always on the tables and stuff like that. And I even didn't notice that, but I was doing that. He one day said, man, you should come by my place and I show you, you know, somehow, you know, sticks, how to do that, you know, because you seem like doing pretty good. And maybe we can get some drums that I don't need. I have some leftovers, so maybe can mount something for you.
Put a kit together.
Yeah. Which, you know, he actually did. So, you know, I had, you know, big in sort of a drum kit, which I brought home, you know, which family was like, oh my God, it's here. So anyway, after some time, I stopped practicing and I got really good. And I got even really that good that I played more and more practice, which the house hated it. The whole house, the whole street, everybody hated it. And they were complaining all the time, which, funny enough, it changed when I become, as I told you that I hated it, pop. I went to play with the band called Flamengo, and played a really a pop kind of a thing, the songs that they make it for the radio famous.
Right.
And when I start doing that, man, the attitude at the building and the street change all of a sudden. How is the boy doing? And is he gonna be practicing around again? We can't wait. We missed it. All of a sudden, everything was completely different. Mom that used to wait on a line in the supermarket, and all of a sudden was on the top of it, of course. So, but anyway, still, that was like some time before it got tough, because we did an album that is a classic till today, and after going a little bit forward now.
Yeah.
Now I'm in 70s. And there we did the album called The Chicken in a Clock, which you heard, I think. And I have the, you know.
This is
actually,
Flamengo?
Yeah. This is the Flamengo. And
what was the Primitives?
The Primitives was, I'm getting to it. Okay. This is like, you know, my pop story. So anyway, okay. This is my drum beginning, right?
Right.
So, you know, I'll get back to the Flamengo later, but now, you know, go back, you know, so I was becoming playing drums, and one day, as I usual, walk with sticks in my back pocket of a jeans, and a bunch of records, you know, that I have, a pretty good, because you couldn't buy a records anywhere in Czech Republic, in those days, and it was banned completely, so the only way, it was sort of like a market, which it would be like, you know, a trade center, you know what I mean? And that would be like in different places that you will find few days before it happened. And it will be always on Sunday afternoon. And you will get there and you'll change the records, or you will, you know, meet the famous people, or, you know, the famous people, you know, will go there, you know, to get the records and stuff like that. You know, when I get famous later on, you know, I was going to the places like that, and I got, you know, a lot of records that people, you know, lend me.
Right.
And, you know, I just get them back. But
it was kind of underground. I mean,
it was not possible to just have a record store. Everything there, it was like either Hungarian, Polish, all the Russian, you know, all the Warsaw Pact, you know, I mean, it was a communism, so the no Beatles, no nothing, no records.
What about radio?
Radio absolutely blocked. There was only one radio station. There was a Radio Luxembourg. In that days, and then in those days, it was the only place that you could actually listen to real music, the real rock and roll. It came off and on, but mostly went on when you had the good reception. Good radio, good radio and good antenna. So you get that.
That's but where you the heard other, and
they used the humming.
Ah, to block it, yeah.
Right, jamming. Same, totally jammed. They jammed the everything that was coming from Germany. For example, you could only see the show in the near border of Germany, West Germany, on these days, that there was a beat club, call it, you know, a show that you had a place, you know, a bands playing live. And you had like early, you know, Jethro Tull, and you had like, you know, Stones, and you had like, you know, everything, but it was like, you know, and it came to Germany, so it played on that show. And you could get it only around the border, because furthermore, it was again jammed. So you couldn't get it anywhere else. So, I start walking on the street. A guy stopped me and said, "Hey, I'm planning to put the band together." I said, "Yeah, okay." I said, "You play drums?" I said, "Yeah, I play drums." He said, "All right, well, we have this place here." So I went to some place. It was like a room, rehearsal room. And there was a bunch of guys, and there was a drums, which was a bass drum, snare, and hi-hat, and I think cymbal. That was
no toms.
No toms. Yeah. And I just learned Woolly Bully. I just learned Woolly Bully. And I was on it so good, right? Yeah, Sam Duchin. So I just was so on it, and, you know, and they just applied, I guess, you know, they said like, "Well, what do you know?" And I said, "Well, do you know the Woolly Bully, for example?" He said, "Well, you know Woolly Bully?" I said, "Yeah, of course. So let's play it." So we played that. Soon as we did that, I was a member. Then, you know, we had a band. So, you know, we said, "All right, call ourselves Primitive." And we were calling ourselves just the Primitive for a long, long time, till the day that I went again and meet this manager that I started the whole thing with, how to get into the
when you were
music business.
For the devil.
Yeah, for the Hell's Devils. People,
devils.
Yeah. So I knew that he was phenomenal, you know, a brain. And
what was his name?
His name is Eugene Fiala. And Evgen in the Czech, actually. But anyway, he was really, 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 really a brain. So anyway, I went after him because, you know, the band was disbanded, you know, the Hell's Devils.
Yeah.
He was, you know, for some, you know, he had problems. A lot of, he couldn't do anything. But anyway, I came to him and I said, "Look, I have this band. But, you know, I have to tell you that one a greatest story is that one day with this band we played and we got very famous because we got songs that was very, either was a cover songs, but it was like Boris the Spider from The Who,
right,
which, you know, everybody loves it here because it was about the Russian Boris and Boris the Spider. It was instant hit. I mean,
there's a band from Japan now called Boris.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah.
Could. Yeah. Well, you know,
comes from a Melvin song.
Right. Anyway, so these, you know, it's like the songs like this. We got pretty soon. We will become very, very famous. And then one day, there were two singers on the beginning. And I had one bass player in the hand. Actually, you know, it was in my back of my head that I wanted to bring him, you know, to play with in somewhere and would be this band, but I couldn't because brother of this second singer was playing bass. So anyway, one day we played, and that was a famous thing. It was a nearby the Army military airport, Gbali. Doesn't matter, it's a part of the Prague, very famous. And we got there engagement for playing every Sunday. It was the tea party, call it. It's a dance party, which is from 3 o'clock in the afternoon till 6 o'clock. You play three sets, 45 minutes, each 15 minutes for that. And we got that place, ran it for about, I don't know, till they stop us, till they put us in a jail. I think it was like 6 months, maybe even that long. And you know, there was the story, it was that how we got stopped, that also the audience, it got so drunk amazingly in these 3 hours that one day you have to take the bus to get into the trams. Because, you know, from into that place, you know, the airport, you have, it was out the Prague. So even those fans in really over 1,000 people used to come, 800,000 people used to come. And they drove buses, so they put extra line at that Sunday. And then the drivers refused to drive because they puke everywhere. I understand that. Yeah, I understand that. And, you know, they would scream to stop the bus that they have to all take a leak and stuff like that. You know, I mean, it was horrifying. You know, I mean, you know, bus driver must be like. But anyway, here we were, young, rowdy, yeah. Rock and roll. And anyway, on one of these shows, actually, some girl painted our lead singer, Ivan's, his name is Ivan, painted his face with like skull and flower and stuff like that. And we talking, this is like 1965, about. And all of a sudden, he at the second set appeared at the show, an audience with the painted face. The audience completely flipped out. And since that, we start painting our faces all the time different ways. And we got people around the primitive group that was the really people, very, 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 very people later on that they were working with plastic people, actually.
Ah.
Those were really artists. And they did things like, for example, anyway, after these shows, we decided that we're going to have to let go the one of the singer and the bass player, his brother. And I finally brought this friend of mine, Pavel, who actually died not long ago, but, you know, I hope, you know, he's going to feel better now. And he was the greatest guy. We got, you know, since that minute. And then also I brought another guitar player, which with those two guys, Zdenek, with these two new guys, we become absolute smashing hit. And everybody went after us.
Are you recording or are you just doing gigs?
We were not allowed to record anything for anybody because there was no communist company that would issue any of our records. They hate us so much. But anyway, there were always some people that actually did against all the wills and, you know, for even with the view that did the shows that they knew that somebody's gonna come and say, well, you have a problem. And they still did it. Anyway, we did this show, which it was one of them, famous, was a birth feast, which we celebrate a birth feast. The way what we did, this is all the ideas of this manager. He had the phenomenal idea. And we had the audience. It was Allen Ginsberg came to the, a lot of them.
Oh, really?
He's seen it. Yeah. He was. We got, you know, actually the on the issue of the Rolling Stone magazine that Janis Joplin died, and that issue there is inside the picture of our bass player and our band with the flames around. So I remember that because it's in that issue, which is, you know, sadly, you know, anyway, but we got into, and we got just because of, you know, people like Ginsberg, because they really love the painting and the psychedelic. We start calling it ourselves a psychedelic band. And we actually, the manager, first thing that he did, I have to definitely, that's important thing, from the primitive, in a minute that he took that, he said, we're going to change the name. We're going to get primitive is good, but it's not meaning we're going to get big. Let's name it Primitive Group. And Primitive Group, no. Let's make it Primitives Group. Let's make the Primitives Group. Yeah, the Primitives Group. That's the name. That's what we're going to go. So all of a sudden, we were the Primitives Group. And it went... You know, in the book, you know, we went as the only psychedelic band in those days. We were the only one. There was no other.
Did you hear Western psychedelic bands like Rocky Erickson or?
No, we didn't.
No. Okay.
At all.
Did you guys eat L?
We.
Did you have LSD?
Oh yeah, because you know the Czech Republic, actually Czechoslovakia in those days,
yeah,
Czechoslovakia.
They made it.
They made LSD-24.
Sardo.
But that's originated from here, and that's where the sugar cubes are, because we were dumping, because you have it in the
vial.
Glass in the valve, so you cut it with the plate of, you know, actually, you know, with the nail
file,
yeah, with a nail file. You just, I lost some of it, man, you know, some English, it's I'm losing it after all these years. So with the nail file, you know, you chop it, and then you drop the drops on the sugar cubes. So that was actually how we did the acid times.
Wow.
And those were the days, because we had that, we had all other things, you know, we had pretty much a lot of everything. We didn't have any wheat or any of these things. We didn't get involved till I actually, first time I smoked, I think, you know, in 68. It was my first time that some American GIs who was visiting Prague came with some hash, and I smoked hash with mixture with the tobacco. God, I got, since that I said, okay, this is the stuff I want to be on. And so I was like, another thing, dropped me, and actually, you know, I didn't become an alcoholic, because I would have, because a lot of Czechs, would, you know, did become, and had a lot of problems, because alcohol in this country, in that time, it was like, I mean, the best beer Pilsner Urquell, it was like for 1 crown 20. In those days, I mean, it was nothing. I mean, you didn't have much, you know, like to pay a monthly. It was like maybe 1,000 crowns or something like that. Maybe, I don't even remember it anymore, but I know the apartment was like 150, maybe 200. Or, you know, it was a funny prices, you know. I mean, you know, you were to the restaurant and ate, you know, for, you know, 4 or 5 crowns. I mean, you know, 10 crowns for a big meal. I mean, it was like real big. You know, to spend 10 crowns, I mean, you were drunk like a dog.
Yeah.
You know? And so those were the days, and you know, everybody, all the kids, it was like into the alcohol and the booze, or since you were probably like, you know, off the milk bottle, you know, I think, you know, the next thing you sucked on was a bottle of a beer. You know, I mean, this country is raised on beer. I mean, you know, we consume probably more beer than anybody else in the world.
Home of Budweiser.
Yeah, so anyway, back to the Primitive Group. So
yeah.
We become really, really successful, and we become really big pain. I mean, we did this bird feast. So the idea of the manager, it was, okay, we're gonna get some birds. So there was these lunatics running everywhere in the parks and gathering whatever could fly, right? So the smart birds, the small birds are smart birds. They usually, you know, it's like, so they, you know, they got pigeons, you know, mostly, right? So they brought that and they let it fly. Then we had in this display, like window displays that usually you put like advertisement, you know, it's like seen through window, right?
Right.
And it's like, you know, sort of a box.
Right.
But it's box, you know, to, you know, what, about a foot, maybe, right?
18 inches about, yeah.
Something like that. And imagine into that, we squeeze a girl naked, and they wrap her into the honey.
Honey?
Right. And then into the feathers.
And feathers.
Right. They bust a bunch of pillows and got the goose feathers and all that feathers. Any feather you can find, you know, every feather you can find. So they wrap, put it on the paper, and they just, she rolled over. Until she, you could see her, but it wasn't naked. So we put those two girls sitting in each side. Man, the people flipped out just from this. And then we like let the birds, you know, fly. Then we played, you know, then they pumped. Then they throw actually some pillow feathers on the people from a balcony. Oh, God, that was like a nightmare. That was everywhere. And then we did also another one, which was called Fish Feast, which was the fish celebration. And we celebrate the, I guess, the ocean and the water and everything. So we call it a fish feast. And that was also his idea. In this time,
the
we
ocean
had,
in Czech.
Yeah, in this time we had a much, much, much more difficult show, which involved an two huge lights, searchlights. I mean, you're talking about searchlights for the airplanes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
From the Second World War, because in that time we didn't have any big lights. So they found some kind of those huge lights, and they put it on each side of this huge Lucerna Hall, on each side of the stadium. Then they put a plastic seeing through in the front of the stage. And then they let us sit through on a month. That this took a month and months of preparation. Also was involved a mate, your replica of your face, which they, of course, put the white stuff,
plaster
on your face, right? And that then you got two tubes coming out of the nose, right? That you can breathe. And some jokers at that time, for example, pull out them, you know, say, hey, you're gonna play or not? All right, and they put it back. You know, so things like that. But anyway, so you have to wait the choice. So anyway, they made faces like us painted gold and hang on the plastic guitars and everything and make a statue painted in gold, and which they like, it looks like us.
Right.
It's
right.
There.
Replicas.
Right. And before they actually, that was all in dark. Only this huge two searchlight was humming, popping the lights like strobing, like strobe light. Not that fast, but that was going into the audience, into the darkness. And then noises from the PA was playing the screams and all kind of stuff, like really panic sirens and all kind of everything, you know, fire engines, you know, all police cars, everything, anything that make weird things.
Freak out.
Now, Then the show started. This stopped them. Actually, the blinking continues. Still, actually, the strobing continue. And then, all of a sudden, the lead singer appeared. When with the lights, he made with a torch that he had and made and cut through the plastic. And the plastic, when it's heat and you know,
right,
with the lights, it was spectacular scene. Anyway, when that happened, he disappeared with that torch. The plastic still there. This is still in darkness with only that strobe, the lights. And all of a sudden, the lights went on as the normal lights. And then at the same time, they let explode our heads. They put...
Oh, the plaster heads.
Yeah. They put explosive enough strong that will... literally explode. Then they drop the net from the balcony, start pouring the water from the hydrant, and drop the bunch of live fish on them. And into that panic we played. You won't believe it, what kind of a situation was going on. God, I never seen it. And you know, those shows were really... And then everywhere flames, lights. I mean... There were more flames. We had more firefighters always, you know, around us when we played gig. That it was like nobody wanted anything. You know what I mean? No, they're gonna burn the place. No. But so we got stopped by the government, and right after that went the plastic people of the universe.
What kind of equipment were you playing?
I played Czech. We played Czech equipment.
Okay. Well, I'm just wondering.
Czech guitars. Czech
amps. Czech drums.
Czech drums.
What were they called? They made by the state and the government.
Yeah. Amati.
Amati.
Amati. That's what was the Amati was the actually the name of the drums, and they actually makes also the woodwinds and a brass instrument.
Were they good? Were they like Ludwigs?
They were terrible.
Oh, they were terrible.
They were terrible.
Okay.
They were terrible. They were worst things you can possibly imagine. But anyway, I mean, you know, we couldn't get hands on anything. You know, so
sure. I'm just curious. How'd you get around?
How we get around?
Yeah, Skoda, vans, was there station wagon?
Different. Mainly it was like regular, you know, things, you know, like regular automobiles, you know, regular cars. You know, that, you know, few times we drove, you know,
trips.
10 people, you know, helped, you know, and equipment were in those days not that big because, you know, you couldn't get any big equipment.
Right.
So usually it was a homemade, two speakers, you know, bass player had like one or two 15s, right? And some kind of amplifier that was, you know, available in here. There was some company that they made them. It was a communist company, but they knew that, you know, the music is happening and, you know, people were buying it, so they were making it.
But you couldn't get Fenders, you couldn't get
That didn't exist. Nothing like that exists. There were only like I think two or three drum set, and you know, after you know this band, you know when I got later on, you know I bought from the Miroslav Vitus, from his brother from Alan. From Alan, I bought a Premier drum set.
Yeah.
The English, and since that was like everything phenomenal. And you know, one day at the festival that we played in Prague in '69, they only want everybody play the Czech instruments made specially for the rock and roll. And I seen the drums and I said, yeah, I can play this because I will destroy them.
It's a toy.
And the guy laughed at me, and I said, I'm telling you. And he said, no, this is the law. Either you play that or you don't play. So I said, okay, it's you the boss. So I played it. Of course, first song came. And I broke one of the toms. Not just broke them, but it busted the piece of the bass drum. the wood broke off. So that fell off. Then,
first song.
Then the cymbal sort of fell off in my one hit, but the whole stand got smashed. Then the bass drum pedal busted completely. Then I went through the snare, and then I played only hi-hat.
The first song.
Then I played only the hi-hat, and it was pieces sticking out of the cymbal. And the stand, it was looking like something you can shoot arrows out. And the guy, after I was done with it, I mean, we talked three songs. After I was done with it, I told him, I said, see what I mean? And he was standing and he said, Oh God, those were our best.
Oh man, I wish you had recordings of this. What were the jams?
Well,
like?
You know, there are some, you know, maybe there are not recordings. There are, you know, we search. There may be one or two recordings available that's possible that someone has of Primitive Group. Maybe I'll be able to collect that and send it, but I already did, since, you know, Steve called me, since that I was looking for everything I could put a hands on.
Well, how would you describe it then? The jams, the songs.
The songs? I mean, you know, they were very good players.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they were very, very, very good players. I mean, it's the music, it's very real, real good. I mean,
it was obviously kind of driving if you're busting up the drums like that.
Right, yeah, but you know, we played in those days, we played, you know, things like...
It wasn't like mellow jams.
So. No, we played really like, you know, the soul, the James Brown song. And God, you know, I Got You... Da, ba, 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 ba. You can't play that thing like shoop, 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 shoop. No, man, you have to whip it. Boy, and I whip it. And that was it. So that did it. Also, you know, that I had that offbeat thing going, you know, because, you know, when you got that, there's a bass drum goes off.
Yeah, yeah.
Man, when I did that, I learned that. Boy, man, I was the best.
Now, were you just so doing music for a living? Did you have a side job?
No.
Now, you were telling me something about these papers you had to carry.
Well, the thing is that, you know, you had identification card, which it was actually like a book, a little red book, which it got your recent picture. You couldn't have the, for example, picture when you have a longer hairs, because they would take you and cut your hairs. They did it to whole Prague. In 1965 or 60, yeah, I think 66. They
got free haircuts.
Everybody got free haircuts. And they, you know, listen to this. You were walking on the street. It doesn't matter who you were with. There will be a car, police, stop, have a door open, they will grab you, stuck you in the car, and you will be going downtown to this gymnasium, which it was like hundreds and hundreds of long hair guys that cheer you up. Hey! And the situation it was that you went to check up through the doctor, right? They check on you if you have any, you know, diseases, you know. And then, of course, comes your hair. And, you know, he goes like, oh yeah, flea lice, shave. So we got all haircuts, man. Government haircuts. I mean, it was like amazing. And they literally did the whole Prague like that. There, I know still guy, his name is a Chicha. It's actually a slang for the kitty cat. And this guy actually had one of the longest hairs, and him and his friend survived it, that his friend worked in a hospital. Because, you know, you see, nobody wants to work for commies. So, you know, we actually work the jobs like, you know, when they put me in a jail, like they disband the band, for example. I mean, the Primitive Group, they disband the Flamenco, they disband all kind of things, you know. So they, you know, you going to get a job. So I get a job. First, I try to be a flower guy didn't work. That was too sick. So then I drove this little electric car in this huge factory where they assembled locomotives, you know, electric. So they have the rotors and all that, you know, for the engine. So yeah. You know, you're driving parts on the electric car from the part of the company, you know. Actually, you know, it was a huge complex. It was one of the biggest, you know, factory in right. Prague existing. And I was driving this little electric car. But the thing is that you have to be in the factory 6 o'clock in the morning. Right. And when you got a gig and you got sleep at 4 o'clock, 6 o'clock you look like zombie. But I have to definitely say on the Czech people, on behalf of Czech people, that they were phenomenal. That at the time that I did that job, that they did, for example, let me go get the car at the place they recharge it, because it's electric car. They recharge it overnight. I picked it up, drove into assembly line where, you know, I would be, you know, put the thing on and start driving, you know, the whole that 8 hours of work. And from that minute that I actually, that was 15, 20 minutes after 6 o'clock, I would be in assembly line and they would take me into the locksmiths, you know, and you got the, actually, you know, the blacksmiths and all these, you know, people, you know, actually, you know, who do, you know, the engineerings, you know, for the, you know, assemble the machine shop, you know, and do it, you know, so, you know, that's machine shop. So they made in one of their working tables, which is, you know, how it's like the working table. Like, you know, in a back, you know, in your garage, you know, so that inside that they put the mattress, blanket, and pillow. I would come lay in there and sleep till 9:30 when it was a break at the factory. It was a first break, then you got a lunch. There was a two breaks that you haven't during a day, and after that break, I'll get up, I'll eat, and I'll start driving the regular thing. God. Which it also include the things that you could easily say, for example, my car is busted, which it would be like, you take the two cables, and you just get the batteries completely dry. Alright, and then you just sit in and wait for 2 hours, smoking cigarettes, man, you know, and looking around. Or, you know, you park it nearby a pub and you go and drink a beer because you know it's going to take them 2 to 3 hours to come and do something, either, you know,
the cables back.
to tow you back, or, you know, just, you know, put some kind of recharge or whatever. I mean, it was like that happening, but you can do it all the time. You know, you can do it like twice a week, yeah, possible. I did it more than that. Then they got rid of me. And then, you know, of course, you know...
Oh, because this book also said where you worked.
Right, because you have to get only... That was, I think it was week or 10 days in between the employee stamp, because you got the one, the day that you start employment, and the date you finish the employment. From the date of finish of employment, right, you have week to 10 days to find another job, or you become public enemy. You will become, you know, that somebody actually doing something for you what you should be doing for yourself. You couldn't have anyone like that.
Right, right.
You know, for example, you would write a symphony and you will have a sponsor for that. As you know, you will have a grant. Right. Right, that will be the normal procedure. Here you couldn't have that, unless you were like the commie writer, and then yeah, that's possible. They find some money for you. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
But if you were your own, you were absolutely in a deep, because there were absolutely no way of out.
You're up shit's creek.
Yes. You're really in deep shit creek. Yes, absolutely. You're really in deep.
So what'd you do about that?
Well,
If they caught you with it longer, 10, 12, you'd get put in jail?
Well, you see, it's like always it was like, for the time being, you know, you were like, you know, in the cells, you know, that they tried to make you signed a papers that you actually were the guy, you know, that done that, you know, something that you will commit.
Ah, confession.
You know, some kind of confession. And I never confessed on anything, because why should I confess on anything? So they did let me go because, you know, I mean, plastic people later on, they got really long sentences. But, you know, we talking already a time that I was gone because I couldn't get it anymore. Because, you know, being like, you know, crazy put into the jobs that, you know, it is really crazy and not to be able to do nothing, you know. And then constantly have, you know, threat over you. I mean, you know, for example, the last band I had, it was like just before my escaping of 1973. The last band I had, the band was called Energy. I actually brought you a CD.
Oh, cool.
And one of them, it's there is a live version, which is the whole version. And, you know, we got people like, we got thousands of people. We got audiences that we got a thing so messed up for us that, for example, we would play this place for about, I don't know, 1,200 people, and there was a glass door, the entry door, and they would just they just walked through that door. I mean, you know, the people were like, there were more and more of them behind that glass until the first one were actually pushed into it.
Oh, man.
And the things like that, you know, it was happening in all our concerts. You know, I mean,
this is early 70s.
This is late 70s. Oh. I mean, you know, in our shows, this was going on all the time. Yeah. I mean, in my shows, in my band.
73, you escaped?
Yes. This what I'm talking, those are shows in 73, a particular. This band,
Energy.
And that band was loved by everybody, but hated by the government so much that you won't believe it. Now, you have to have and the papers as an artist to obtain these papers. You have to have actually this qualification, right? And there is the bunch of old farts. A bunch of old farts sitting in there and try to give you all questions of the theory of the communists and every other kind. You know, it's a nightmare. But but can we stop this because we have to go?
Yeah, this is getting.
There's no problem.
Yeah, but you know, we just back for a minute and we'll continue.
Thanks, Jago.
Yeah, because you know I'll know this. You know I'll remember this.
Bye.
was You're Not Blank, so Baby We're Through by the Dills. And before that, we had Templates from Home. I had the Go Team with the Bongo Tribe. And, well, it's actually now the next day. We're coming up to the end of the first hour of the September 19, 2008, Watt from Pedro Show, back with Yarda and his spiel on qualifications.
Yeah. So we left it on.
Well, not yet. We got to get into hour two, so hold tight. September 19, 2008, it's the second hour of the Watt from Pedro Show. And we got a Yarda Sadaivi.
Yes, indeed.
Here, Mr. Steve McKay.
Hey.
We're at what is this? Royal Crown? Oh, Crown Royal? Crown Plaza. Hotel Castle. Although it's not a castle, but it's called that here in Prague.
Yeah, because it's near castle.
It's near the castle.
Yes.
So, well, people get weird ideas about people playing music. You know, you stay in castles, right?
Sometimes we do.
I played in a castle in Italy. But it's actually the next day. It's September 20th, because we had to stop the recording yesterday to go to a gig. What was the name of that town?
The town is Cernosice.
Cernosice. Okay. How do you spell that?
Cernosice, it's Cernosice.
Okay.
Cernosice.
Yeah, and it's I guess you'd call it almost a suburb of Prague. It wasn't that far out.
What,
a half hour?
Yeah,
it's about 20 minutes.
And it's... Your leash is tugging on you.
I'll call you later.
We get out there, and there's a Soko Hall, which kind of blew my mind, because I've played Soko Hall. You know, I didn't know it was a Czech term.
It was a theater. Soko, it's actually, you know, an organization, is a sport organization that it's, you know, since the 1920s, mm-hmm. 1920, something like that, or maybe even earlier, it's been established in Czech Republic, and it's been like gymnastic and all sports, actually all sports kind of, you know, place where they have the basketball hall, you know, there they got a building where, you know, do all sport, you know, things, you know, whatever it is, and it's called Sokol.
So what happened was the Czech cats who emigrated over probably started their own Sokol halls there. And, you know, especially in the older punk days, we played a lot of ethnic halls. They would rent them out cheap. They didn't have prejudice against different kinds of music. So Ukrainian hall, Polish hall, Italian American club, you know, VFW halls, Moose Lodge.
Yeah, all these kind of things.
More than the rock and roll clubs, because the rock and roll clubs kind of didn't.
Yeah,
very much. Not big punk.
No, I understand.
So we're playing a lot of those. Anyway, this place used to be a cinema, right? A theater.
Yes, it used to be a cinema.
And it was great. Had brand new JBL system. Great sound.
Wonderful
there.
Sound.
The
great
band
audience
that opened up had a surgeon singing. The singer.
Yeah.
What was his name?
He's the Zdenek Hribal. It's Hribal, actually, you know, that's what his name. But he's a chief surgeon of the Motol Hospital, of the kids unit.
Right.
And he does he's very, very...
He does open heart surgery.
Yeah. He does, you know, all the surgeries. That's actually surgeon, you know. I mean, you know, that's the guy who did, you know, And he is the lead singer of the band.
Yeah, what were they called?
They call it White Disease.
White Disease,
which is,
right.
I think, you know, it's like...
Is it English, or do they use Czech?
Bílá nemoc.
That's what they're called.
That's what's the name. Bílá nemoc, which is White Disease.
White Disease. Okay. Oh, yeah, Belgrade, White City.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's what their name means. Yeah, it was a trip for me hearing all those sounds, because the Stooges ain't a lot in Eastern Europe.
Right.
Or it went over in Europe, or in the western part. But in my town, Pedro, I'm here in the Slav all the time, so last night was like being home.
Yeah?
It was a trip to hear that all night. I really liked it. And after White Disease was... did you have a name for that last night?
It's an OMDB, I'm calling it. Well, it was an on-the-spot, actually, name, which is...
On-the-spot.
Yeah, it's called...
Okay. And on-the-spot was Yard on the Drums.
Over my dead body.
It was Yard on Drums, Steve on Sax, Julie...
Julie Gubel.
Gubel on the sax on and keyboard and singing.
And Tono was doing...
On the bass.
And Tony was doing the bass. Yeah.
Right, right. So they... was basically improvisation.
Right.
Yeah,
and the only
really
one
good
song she sung, you know, that was pretty impressive, actually. You know, she's got pretty good voice, which I didn't know. And then she played keyboards.
Which you just asked her to, right?
She
didn't know that was coming.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's just like, you know, hey, do something, you know what I mean? And she just like, she haven't played piano actually for 20 years or something like that. You know, she's, you know, I mean, you know, she started as the, you know, an age of 7 or 8 or something like that, you know,
right,
very early, you know, pianist. And all of a sudden she started playing really, but she was like, she'd seen you, so she was more into like, you know, doing saxophone than the keyboards, you know.
Oh,
it was
okay.
Like, you know, Steve was there.
Yeah, there was points though where she did both.
And she was so happy, man. Like, you know, she was like taking a big hits,
and
taking a big grabs of your knowledge, you know.
It's, oh, yeah, yeah.
That was really, really for that was a trip.
Tony was playing really good too. I liked him a lot. So it was a good gig. It was a good
time.
Well,
you played some too, George.
Yeah, you played pretty good.
You were out of your mind. It was great.
Well, many pivos.
Yeah, definitely.
And Mota.
We all did pretty good, yeah.
Oh, man, had to take the fifth string off.
Oh, that everybody has to know that, you know, all of a sudden there is Mike, in the middle of the song, it start ripping the fifth string. The low, you know, the low B is coming out, and I mean, it's coming out, it goes like...
The strap was too high, so I had to sit on the amp, little amp.
Then he sat on the amp, oh God.
Yeah.
Nightmare. No, but anyway...
Yesterday we were talking about getting a music qualification.
Right, right.
We're going back to the 70s,
right? Right, 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 right. So, we end up about, you know, these old farts sitting in there that you're going through the qualification. And it's, you know, about qualification for being able to play music. You know, they qualify you and give you a possibility to have a state-run agency. You can get yourself a manager who will actually find for yourself a job or a gigs, you know, to play. And if the counties agree with your way, that's what the qualifications were all about, you know, then you have the permission to actually have been written in that identification card where you got those stamps, employed and unemployed. You have written a freelance employee. You know, I mean, freelance musician.
Right.
So, you
know...
So,
you're not illegal.
So, you know, I had, you know, many times I went, you know, and many people of this, of our branch, come into the problems with the cops when they stop us. We didn't have any of the stamps on the pages. We were empty pages, and they were like...
But you said you knew some of the cops who busted you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, they were doing it. This is like, you know, I mean, they did it for a reason because I had a long hair. You know, the guys who had long hairs, you know, I'm living in a one corner and being like on the next corner is the supermarket. I wake up every morning and went there to get me a fresh roast, you know, some whatever, you know, breakfast stuff, you know. And you know, there's a cop standing on the corner. I'm coming in, your identification card. And I'm go like, hey, you know, check name Milan, you know, like, what, you know me? And I was like, I've been living over there for years, for God's sake. Identification card. So I didn't have that. So they take me to the car, right? in my things, you know, that I'm going just around the corner, you know, I'm not dressed, you know, to go in into the city. They drive me into the police station, you know, and my mom and my dad, you know, would have to, somebody would have to come and bring the identification card, and then they let me go. And that's happened many times. Same as like, you know, it's, you know, like anybody who had the freelance musician, you know, they were like, why don't you have a stamp? And, you know, I always like told them like, look, can you imagine if I have a stamp, since I have a 30 gigs a month? Because we did have that money. And
so stamp for every gig.
So I said, we'll be first employed at 8 o'clock and unemployed at 10:30. All right, and then the next day I'll be, you know, at 50 miles away from another town, employed and unemployed. I mean, isn't that stupid? I said, you would give me a, you would have to give me a book about this big.
1,000 pages.
You know, I mean, for the, you know, I mean, you say that this, you know, that's actually, you know, the identification, you know, book. It was, you know, 5 years, and you know how many stamps I would collect in 5 years in this? I mean, you know, are you crazy? So finally they drop on that. But in many occasions we got busted and we got in trouble until somebody with more, you know, stars on that, and, you know, a little higher position will come and say, all right, you stupid. Yeah, that's true, you know, I mean... But, you know, the discussion before that, you know, and all the, you know, everything, it will take forever, you know what I mean? They will check on this, they will check on that, and they will don't like the hairs, and why don't you have a hairs, you know, same length now? And I would go like, you know, because, you know, I don't know how much they long every month. I mean, should I measure it and then cut it or what? You know what I mean? You know, it's long enough that you can see.
So you look like the picture.
Yeah. And if you, for example, cut your hair, you know, you have to get immediately a new one. Right? With a new picture. So you got the new picture. Okay, you got a new picture. Then, you know, you grow the hairs, and as soon as, you know, the hairs start covering your ears, you know, it would be like, you can't do that. You know? So you're back again, get another one, applying with the long hair, right? In this time again, right? Then you got the long hair, you know, that, you know, and then it took, oh, God. They didn't, some of the places, they didn't want to take your picture with the long hair. They said, no, you're looking very nice, a cut like that. No, go back and cut your hairs again. And things like that. So anyway, this qualification, you know, it was all about hairs too. That's why I'm talking about it. Because, you know, we did have a long hair, for example. And we appealed in this qualification, you know, which was a, you know, a really a table with these people that they give you a questions about nothing to do with what you actually doing. It was the about the Russian composers, you know, it was about the blah blah blah, it was about this, you know, it was about the classical blah blah blah, and you playing rock and roll, man, you start doing, you know, sort of like a punkish, you know, psychedelic things, and you know, you're supposed to know that. Then we always have one guy in the band who had some musical knowledge, you know, because he was either kicked out of the music school or conservatory or whatever. So, like a Juilliard or something like that. So all of a sudden, he would be the guy who would be a spokesman, and he was the leader of the band, right? So he goes, you know, read notes, you know, has the, you know, all the knowledge about the Russian composers and blah, blah, blah. And then we go on a stage and play. Now, you look like a monkey, because you got those monkey suits, three-piece, right? You got the tie, you know what I mean? And then you can wear the hat, because if you wear the hat, it would be easy to stick the hat under, right? No problem. But, no, that they knew that, so no hair, no hats allowed. So then, the only thing, a girlfriend of ours worked on us and put the hairs in back and under the shirt, and then you know, really tied it up with the tie, and then you actually worked like a rubber, because, you know, anytime you would stand just the head, the hair will pop up. So you have to move your body and talk like that, you know what I mean? And then on the stage, standing still straight, you know what I mean? And as a drummer, you know,
not moving anything, you know, I mean, no, like, anything,
you know, it's like, literally, like, you know, I thought, you know, that we were actually at this place, that we were first Devo. I would think, you know, it really looked like, you know, I mean, you know, a bunch of robots playing, you know, a really pop, stupid song that has no idea, no clue, we didn't even know, we learned that song because we had to, and, they, you know, either say, okay, well, you know, you get the qualification 1, 2, or 3. All right? If you had a 1, you have a really like little money. You know, 2, you have a little more money. And a 3, you know, you get like about 300 Czech crowns a gig, you know, which it was pretty good. And so we had, I think, the primitives group, you know, basically we never did this qualification. Because, first of all, we wouldn't be able to do that. Because none of us knew anything. What do they ask us? We tried twice, and every time they threw us out. In first moment, we said, no, we will first play, and then we will talk to you. They said, no, that's not like we do it. And he said, we don't care. So they just throw us out because, you know, they said, we don't want to talk to you. And the other times, you know, no one knows anything. And then finally, our manager, who was actually a very qualified musician, he, for some reason, and somehow through an agency, got us under the, you know, it's like entertainment theater agency, which it includes like a comedians and a flamethrowers and all kind of, you know, all kind of, you know, it's based like art, circus or whatever.
Vaudeville.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. And we got under that agency without any, you know, any of this qualification, you know, done it. And he was able to actually live pretty quiet for quite a while. I think, you know, for a few years until they finished the band. That was it. Because the Flames and the Fish Feast that did it. And
right.
That was that. So, you know, after, you know, all these, you know, we did, you know, the qualification the second time, you know, just before I escaped. We were doing it with the Energid. And Energid is very loved band. So we did, you know, this with the Hairs. Right, you got it. And there's two CDs in it.
Okay.
In a pack. One is a live one, the whole show live. Okay. Yeah. From the concert of this, you know, I told you that, you know,
what were these two songs?
The two songs, they are recorded actually, you know, in a little studio. Actually, it was in Strahov. This here is a college.
What year?
In 1972.
Wow. You were able to record.
Yes, well, we did it actually, believe it or not, but we did it on my Sony two track, a tape deck. And a little board, which I think it was a 5, maybe, or 6
channels,
and plugged it stereo in, and we played, you know, these songs, and actually, you know, it sounded pretty okay for
that. Let's play one right now.
There's no mix, and there is nothing, you know what I mean? Absolutely, there is absolutely just
right.
Like...
Let's play one right now.
All right.
Watt from Pedro show. That was Energet with
yes.
Blue Dance.
Blue Dance.
And 1972. You're on the drums.
Yeah, I'm on the drums. There is a guitarist, Lubos Anders. Then it's Ivan Kant on the lead singing, and he's a great vocalist. And there's on the bass. It's Lada Padrunet. So these are actually people, you know, on the Energet. And as I told you, you know, those are the stiff guys. And we went through the qualification. We got the highest, and we actually, you know, did, you know, bunch of gigs, you know, until they really bust us, you know, really bad. But, you know, the thing is, like, you know, you got on the other CD, there's the concert from that music hall that I told you that they bust the windows and all that and stuff, you know. And it sounds like actually you are in a soccer concert, or actually a soccer game, you know, something like that. Or, you know, it's really like the people just loved it. And then at the end of that, the cops came and stopped the show.
Right.
And the people doesn't want to leave, so they were like, "Oh man, no!" And they start, you know, destroying the thing. So I had to go on a stage and calm them down. You know, it's like, please, they will put us in a jail. You know, it's not about this. You know, I mean, you know, do you want us, you know, them to stop? You know, so finally they quiet down, and it was okay. But it was the first kind of a burn, you know, in the, you know, Energet story, because, you know, so soon. You know, later on, for example, we played out of Prague and outside the Prague concert. And, of course, came truckload of people by the train. So when the show was finished, it was around midnight when everything, you know, we got it all together. You know, we got, you know, transportation. But the rest of the people, of course, want to take a train. And there was no stop. There was only the fast train passing by, because this station, you know, it was only for a daytime operation, you know.
Right.
So, they lied on the trucks, and they stopped the fast train, and they boarded the train. And it was, next morning we got, you know, people from the secret police pick us up all, and you know, it was all these discussions, and you know, why do you do that, and you know, blah blah blah. We didn't know anything about it. We find it from them, you know. But this, you know, was going more and more until, you know, the moment that we had no place absolutely to play, and I decided I have to get out of here. And that moment I had a girlfriend, which she was in Copenhagen, Denmark, and she made actually non-existing exhibition of the old drum and brass instruments, and that I had like printed posters from her from Copenhagen send it to me, and I had people that I had the passport worked out through them. And I obtained the passport with the 4 days permission actually to see that exhibition.
To be a photographer.
Right, to be a photographer. And, you know, so I...
Although there's really no exhibition. Yeah, I
never took a picture in my life. Actually, I started making the pictures in Copenhagen. It was funny. I did it for a year and then I dropped that on that one. But... I never did any. I never had the camera, so no. This was like, you know, actually,
it was just,
you know,
a trick to get.
Yeah, absolutely. It was totally, you know, like, you know, to make believe that I am something, you know, that I'm not. I mean, you know, and then, you know, it was like, do I'm gonna take the route through the East Germany, or do I gonna take the route directly to the West Germany border, which was the hardest one to go, because, you know, that was like, oh, nightmare. And then go to through East Germany, which was even worse nightmare, because East German, though, there you got the Czech control and the East German control. And then you get, when you go in on the boat to Denmark, you get another German control, you know. So that was like too much for me, so I decided I'm going to take a plane.
fly.
Yeah, they could just fly to Copenhagen. So I bought a ticket, and because I couldn't really announce that I'm leaving the Republic, I couldn't tell anyone. So actually, my family didn't know till the very, very day that, you know, I let them know that I'm going and I'm not coming back. And my mom was the greatest. She said, yeah, I knew this was coming. I knew, it's good luck. Poor lady died when I was in exile, but, you know, tell you the truth, she was my biggest fan, you know, and they called her rock and roll mom, and she had, you know, her, you know, when we played, she had, you know, her special place, you know, a balcony, that she was in this hall when we played in Prague. Yeah, when we played this Lucerna Hall, you know, she was sitting there, and the spotlight always went there, you know, and then the guy who was announcing the show, and hey, here's Erno's mom, you know, the rock and roll mom, because, you know, she was doing things like very, you know, she actually feeds so many musicians.
Does she call you Erno? Erno is a Yarda's nickname.
Yes, I mean, you know.
Tell how you got that name.
This has come from the movie that calls, you know, the thief. And he was the Mickey Rooney played that movie. And it was about a bank. It was about a locksmith who becomes accidentally bank robber. That, you know, it's dragged into this sink, and it's a really funniest comedy, you know, that this, you know, a whole Prague loved it, and the guy who plays the Mickey Rooney, his name's Erno. So, because he looked like me, and we looked very much like it, the next day everybody was calling me Erno. And I got, actually, you know, that name stayed with me for all the times. Even today, no one else knows me as a Yarda. Because, you know, and I even got into the fights that I was, you know, called that, you know, I'm imposter and all kind of things. And I'm trying to pretend to be Erno and all that, you know. And I was like, oh, okay, all right, never mind. Just don't beat me for my own name. Sorry, I was born.
But, you know, what year do you make the flight?
The 1973. The date was the 10th of September.
Wow, you just had the anniversary.
Yeah, yeah.
Last week.
Yep.
So you fly to Copenhagen.
I flew to Copenhagen.
And you make it through the
control. I went through the border. I present all the documents and everything. They look through my
face. Oh, yeah, you had some cameras.
Yeah. They went, you go through the one place to another one to a third room. There's a three rooms and there's a different people looking at your eyes direct, you know. And you have to, like, they study you if, you know, what the hell are you, you know what I mean? So, I went through all that, boarded a plane, flew out, right? Came to Copenhagen, enjoyed the life, and immediately I just, basically, you know, I forgot about the checks. I wrote it on the embassy. I wrote this letter that I still have it even saved somewhere, that I hate communism in any which ways. And I can't come back to the country that I hate. I will only be able to come back when they will be gone. So, that promise I actually did, because, you know, I came back not even after, you know, they took over and get the Czech Republic and split up also the Czechoslovakia, yeah. You know. I came first time, you know, with, you know, A Life After Life, which was the band under Jello Biafra.
Right. What did you do right away in Copenhagen?
In Copenhagen?
Playing music?
Yes, I did start playing with the Burning Red Ivanhoe. It was the local Danish band in those days, you know, it was very, very popular. So I played with these people and I got a gig right away.
How'd you meet them? Just went to a club and...
Yeah, that's what it was. My thing it was that I did it in San Francisco too for the Albert Collins.
Wow.
You know, I, all of a sudden, you know, in some point when was a break, I would climb up on the stage and sit by the drums and start playing. And when I did that, they start playing with me. That was with Albert, for example. He was tuning up the guitar, and I climbed in. It was a little place, was a Blue Moon Cafe, and it was
San Francisco on Main Street. It was
a like really really nice small place, and he was playing there, and the musicians went off the stage, and it was like about this step, you know, the stage, and Albert was like doing the tuning. And I decided this is my chance. So I just passed by him, and he was like looking at me, who's that? And I set my drums and just started playing. And he stopped tuning and started playing. And he goes to microphone, starts singing and starts screaming, hey, the rest of the guys, come on and play. Wow. And so I play.
You know, back to Copenhagen. You did this to the Red...
No. This is in America. In Copenhagen, you know, I went, you know, let's go back to Copenhagen. Yeah. You know, when I went...
Did you speak Danish?
No. I don't think, you know, you are capable of... you know, it's a language that...
But a lot of them know English. Were you speaking English?
Yeah.
What did you learn in school?
Well, not really, you know. I didn't know much of anything, you know. I learned English basically from television in U.S. later, but...
Yeah, but
I did.
Coming out of the country, I'm just wondering how was it to survive without.
It was tough. It was really tough. It was hands and every movement, body move, and then you know all kind of you know. Then you know it was a mishmash. Some of German, some of Danish, and some English.
Okay.
So you know with that, you know
I. Did you get in the band?
I get in the band, you know, because. Went to the music store. While I was in the music store, I tried. That was a brand new Ludwig drums, so I tried. It was a red one. I tried them, and while I was trying them in the store, was the guy who was the leader of this band, and he goes, "Man, you're playing pretty good." And I say, "Yeah." And he goes, "Where are you from?" Because you know, I did. You know, we were. You know. He also spoke little English. So, you know, basically that was like really blah, 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 what, yeah. And I, you know, tried to explain it that I just escaped, you know, I'm from, you know, actually, you know, the communism, you know, I'm brand new. This was like my first days and looking for to do something. And I hope, you know, to get the, because, you know, music, it's my life. And he goes like, yeah, well, you know, come to the rehearsal. And I said, well, I have nothing to rehearse on. And he goes, well, why don't we take these drums that you just, you know, was trying on? And I said, well, you know, I can't buy them, you know. And he goes like, well, you know, I got them. Yeah, I don't have to buy them because we are like, you know, we actually own this store.
Wow.
So you will have them sitting at the rehearsal place, which, you know, I came in, you know, the next day, and that was that drum set. So we stopped playing, and we played around.
Is that the first time you ever played a Ludwig set?
No. I had, with Energy, I have a Ludwig set in here. Because, okay. You know...
No more Tommy?
We had, I had it delivered from Germany, which it was really, really good, you know. And it was same as a Ringo's. So had the same spark, you know,
they were starting to get equipment into check.
Right. Okay. That was becoming, start being the Marshalls, you know, and stuff like that. And the people, you know, just were, you know, going out and coming back, you know, because, you know, it was possible to go out and got back because, you know, they got your family that if you don't come back, the family hall goes to jail. What will happen to them, nobody would know.
Well, what happened when you went to Copenhagen, your family?
Well, that was a different story because my family said that they didn't know.
Ah.
You know, in this way, you know, when you were permitted to go to the West, for example, you know, you would have to sign a piece of paper, you know, that you will come back.
Yeah, right.
You know, or the persecution of the, you know, family will follow immediately.
Yeah.
And right after, you know, the playing around the Copenhagen with this Burning Red Ivanhoe people, which, you know, we got pretty
what
good.
What kind of music?
It was kind of rock, but Scandinavian rock. So
they play their own tunes.
Yeah, and it's like it was, you know, in those days I was very much into, you know, Zeppelins, you know, and you know the Jethro Tull, and you know, I mean, you know, that was a lot of, in those days it was a Blind Faith,
yeah,
it was a Steven, there was a lot of choices on the music,
yeah,
you know, that you know, it was coming either from England and from States. From States, I love, you know, the Buffalo Springfield, you know, and then all the following Birds and everything, you know, from the day one, and of course the Lynyrd Skynyrd. That was the also fantastic story, man, that I seen the Lynyrd Skynyrd first concert that I saw. It was a Fishbone. It was the Indian band.
Redbone. I saw, man.
Right.
Redbone, not
Come
Fishbone.
And get your
that's, yeah, that's yeah, a ska band. Redbone.
Yeah.
That was the 1973. Indian guys, man,
yeah.
I loved them. I saw them in Tivoli, which is, you know, in Copenhagen,
yeah,
place. I saw them in there, and finally I see something,
yeah,
you know,
good,
from States direct.
They wore Indian outfits.
And
did you record with these guys?
What is that?
The Red...
No, we never hacked. Actually, we did some radio show that probably it's laying somewhere in a station somewhere in Copenhagen.
Okay.
And after that, I've been introduced to this lead singer. I don't really remember anymore her name. She was like really big lady, but she sung really, really gospelish. And with her, I played a lot of blues dates, kind of blues rock it was. More not blues, but blues rock. Was like moving. And she was really like, you know, for what she was, how big she was moving like... I was and singing fantastic.
It's and still in Denmark.
Still Denmark. She was Danish. And then, you know, I got introduced by her to these black guys from South Africa, which their names were Dollar Brand.
Oh, wow.
The pianist and Johnny Deani, the acoustic bass player.
Yeah.
And they were looking for a drummer.
Man.
And I said, well, I could do that. And that, so there was like bunch of drummers auditioning for. And I went in and we started jamming like we did yesterday. And after an hour, he said, all right, you're in band.
You got the gig.
Because, you know, I believe that, you know, that my heart was so beat, you know, beat up for the freedom, you know, that, you know, same those guys from South Africa, they
yeah,
got the same feeling. So I guess, you know, we connected.
So you start touring with them.
So I start touring, and we went to Sweden. We did a bunch of Swedish dates. You know, we went to, you know, Denmark. We went to Germany. We did, like, pretty good. And then all of a sudden, you know, it's like, I thought, I'm going to go to America. That's, you know, definitely, that's the story that I have to do. So, you know, I went, you know, got the papers, and went... got me a little Mini Cooper car, put the drums in it, because I, you know, this is also, you know, before this, and he's as crazy as I am sometimes, I thought in that store, you know, when we finished, when I started playing with the Dollar Brand, I didn't have a drums again, of course, because they took it, the Red Ones, you know, away, the Ludwigs, so I went to the another store, and I said, you know, what's cheapest, you know, drums possibly, you know, so I was trying to figure out what I can do, and then I look, and in that corner, it's like this pink painted drum set, right? And I go, what's that? And he goes like, oh, he's throwing this out. So I'm going to it, and I see it's Gretsch. And it's old Gretsch. It must have been like 60, 69, maybe 70, not more, because, you know, this is 73 and was looking old already, and I beat up pretty much. So anyway, they give it to me, and I bought, you know, some cymbals, I bought, you know, some hardware to it, and I worked on it, I sanded, you know, the paint and all that, and I painted white, it will look good, and I actually was so happy on these drums that they sounded so great that I literally brought it with me to States.
Wow.
And when I was in airport in Kennedy at the cargo, because I ship it cargo, it cost me $500.
Yeah.
In those days. I mean,
that's
you're talking 1975.
No, that's like $1,000, yeah, at least.
I mean, you know, and 500, you know, and you know, when I paid for it, when I actually, you know, when the cargo arrived, they let me know I was staying in New York City at a friend of mine's place, and there comes, you know, the phone call, the cargo, your drums are here, come and get it. So, you know, I went, you know, to the cargo place in, you know, up in the Kennedy Airport, and went to the office, you know, got everything, and then the guy said, you are bringing here a Gretsch drum set? For $500, don't you know that you can buy it at Manny's? The same brand new thing, include maybe what you can for same price have a two of those.
Yeah, but it wasn't sanded by Yarda.
You know, and then you know, I told him, but you don't know what is it sound like.
Yeah, you know,
and you know, he laughed and he said, "Oh, come on." He didn't even search if it, you know, when you know, those days didn't no one really looked through the instruments or anything, you know. So you know. So I took the drums, and everybody was crazy about, you know, like, you know, why did I brought these drums and all that. But soon as I started playing on them, everybody knew what did I did. That was a pearl. It was really a pearl. It was a fantastic, fantastic
Hard to get Gretsch. Drum sets around Manhattan,
yeah.
though.
And it's like, you know,
what
it
would
actually,
you do, use a cab?
Yeah, yeah. From Kennedy? Yeah, yeah.
No, when you did gigs in Manhattan, I've always wondered about living there.
I used, you know, a friend's, you know, with the station wagons,
of course,
and then I used the cabbies. You know, the big New York, in those days it was the square.
The checker cabs.
The Chevy, the checker cabs, yeah.
So how long did you live in New York?
I was in New York for a, let's say, I started speaking English very good, actually. At the time that I told you, the first I got the TV set I bought me, and the whole cartoon of the Marlboro cigarettes, the whole 10 pack, you know, and I thought, all right, now, finally. And those days I was smoking, carton, yeah. And so sitting smoking cigarettes, watching the TV, the commercials actually, you know, get me the way to, you know, how it's a vase, you know, done, you know, and blah, blah, blah. And make story short, you know, I did pretty good, and this deli that was on the corner that I used to go and shop as usual every day. Every day I come there, they made all kind of talks, you know, and, you know, like, those were Greeks, I believe. And they make, you know, all these talks, but it was in English, it's, you know, with the coffee. He wants coffee. And, you know, and give him a bagel with a schmear. You know, you want tomato on it too? Or on a coffee? Oh, yeah. And then, you know, it's like, and in between he has these, you know, like, you know, things, funny things, because he knew that I did not understand. And one point, you know, I'm there after, you know, must have been like, what, 3 months, 4 months down the road. I'm going to a deli, and I finally hear, oh yeah, that dude that doesn't understand, he's here again, you know, he's, you know, give him the bagel, the schmear, and you know, and then coffee, and watch out, he's going to be start talking, and that's going to be the sad story. And you know, I hear in the, finally, you know, I got to hear, you know, what is actually, you know, going on, and I go like, whoa, wait a minute. Guys,
I understand.
And then, you know, the guy, you know, who was like, the boss goes like, left the hand up and says, everybody, listen to me. He understands for now. We quit that shit, all right? So no more, man. It was like, no more funny jokes and no more that, you know.
So I'm playing gig. What kind of gigs are you doing in Manhattan?
In Manhattan, at the beginning, there was almost no gigs, but it was really tough. The first my days, you know, basically I did more specified on learning English, And I went throughout, you know, the clubs, the scenery, you know, the bottom line, and, you know, all the jazz clubs, all the rock clubs, you know, that, you know, in those days still was, you know, even Fillmore was working on, you know, and so I seen, you know, all kind of bands. It was marvelous time. And I was more learning to watching the drummers and all that, and, you know, communicating with them, because everybody spoke English. It was wonderful. And I was like, you know, learning it more and more, and it was like pretty good. So after the 4 months, then comes the phone call from my old roadie, who also escaped. His name is Ilya, and lives in Bolinas. And he called me from that time he was living in Ross, because he got married to the girl, very, very rich girl, and Ross, as Steve will tell you, it's basically Beverly Hills of Marin County. Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, you got castles in there. Yeah. And believe it or not, funniest story.
Over? Huh? Come on over to the West Coast?
Yeah, well, he goes, hey, man, what are you doing there? And I go like, man, I'm freezing my balls. You know, and, you know, it started being warmish. And he goes like, man, you know, I'm just in a shorts and a T-shirt. And I go, man, I'm coming. So, again, ticket.
Bring the drums.
Ticket, the drums. No, I ship it by the truck in this time, because the price in States, you know, it was like a little bit different, you know, like, I mean, I said no cargoes anymore, all right, the planes are out, you know, so let's get the trucking company and let's get that, you know, on the road. So it cost me about $100 in those days.
Yeah.
So it was pretty good. It came week later. But anyway, that week, you know, I had, you know, in San Francisco, I came there, you know, and I lived in Ross, got swimming pool, Jesus Christ. And believe it or not, my drums came in, right? And then right across the street, actually, it's like, you know, if you know Ross, there's no really streets. When you go off the main street, those are like willow trees and all the kinds. You go in like, it's like a jungle, you know, the roads. But it's, you know, it's really pretty. But across our jungle, across our street, the house was actually a band called Clover.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I know those guys.
Who Huey become Lewis. The Huey Louie, you know, yeah, and right. They were looking.
They also recorded, I think, first Elvis Costello.
Yes, they did.
Yeah. So they were looking for a drummer. So I was there, I was in Ross, and the bass player, that was his house, and he goes like, well, we're rehearsing in Tarolinda, where was the rehearsals, where, you know, Huey was rehearsing later on, and everybody else was rehearsing there. But, you know, I mean, all the
Jefferson's, I rehearsed up there.
Starship and the Grateful, that everybody was, yeah.
It was the bass player's house. It just became like a jam house.
No. This is like the studios, complex of the studios.
Oh.
It's a warehouse buildings, yeah, that they built into, you know, the rooms.
Sure.
And, you know, each band's got, and it was like, you go, there was a Jefferson Starship, there was a Grateful Dead, there was a, you know, Clover in that time, and there was blah, blah, blah. It was like all the San Francisco bands.
Wow.
You know, a Marine, actually, you know, every old Marine can, you know, was there. So everybody, you know, from, you know, you meet him, you know, I was like in heaven. So, you know, here I am, did the audition, did a bunch of gigs, you know, playing a little bit. And then all of a sudden I got a phone call from a friend of mine from Los Angeles that he's going down there to play with the bass player Pat O'Hara, which is the Zappas.
Yeah.
Bass player. And I heard that, said, okay, I have to go. So I went down there, we played, and he turned me on the Mike Hoffman, who was the guitar player for the Lifetime, Tony Williams.
Yeah.
That was Mikey Hoffman. I mean, insane guitar player. Insane. I mean, you know, literally.
Great drummer, Tony Williams.
Yeah, and it was the best group. If you remember, he had a quartet. Rocking, you know, it was fusion, but it was more rock. And he had that greatest album. That's Mike Hoffman's playing the guitar on it. And
Tony Williams' Lifetime or something.
Yeah.
But he had different versions.
Yeah, but this was the rock. There was really diffusion. Only four guys on it.
Right.
And it was really, really really electric guitar, electric bass, and all that. So Pat turned me on a bass player, on this guitar player, and this guitar player turned me on a bass player, which name is Doug Lunn, which Doug Lunn played with pretty much everybody, with Milcho Leviev, and a lot jazz scene.
Yeah, for sure.
What is that guitar player?
McLaughlin?
No, not McLaughlin. He was... he got shot.
Oh.
Larry Carlton. So he was playing with him. He was playing also with Coriel, you know, and with all these, you know, with all these people he played. So we had with the Russian guy, lead singer, we put a band together quickly did the recording actually for almost no cost from because Doug Lunn, he knew some studio in Hollywood. We went there, we cut a bunch of tracks, we put it around, people liked it. So we were just about to cut record when the lead singer decided that he's gonna move to San Diego. So, collapse back in San Francisco, doing again nothing, right? And thinking, well, what the hell am I gonna do? So, put the all different bands and played. That was a guy, guitar player, Ivo Krizan, that he had a bunch of things. You know, and he played actually, you know, with a bunch of people that were already involved in the San Francisco scene. And the other person who helped me a lot was Miroslav Vitus, because he actually lived there, and I put the... actually, I called Jan Hammer, and he gave me a number.
He played with John McLaughlin in Mahavishnu Orchestra.
Yeah. So Jan gave me the Miroslav's number. I called Miroslav. Miroslav was really happy to hear about me. You know, we got together. You know, I went, you know, to see this show. He was doing it. He's got this electric band, Miroslav Vito's band, and
this is after Weather Report.
Yeah. This one he was doing it solo, and he was doing the double neck. He had the bass and a six string guitar, and he had a lead singer. There was his girlfriend of his, and some, you know, not sure, you know, don't remember that much because it was really weird. But anyway, remember Miroslav's that. One morning, I was living in Oakland in that time, and one morning, there's a banging on the door, and there's Miroslav standing there with a Jaco Pastorius album, solo, the first solo album, and he goes, "Man, I have to wake you up, you gotta hear this dude, you won't believe, he's the best," and he said, "Last track on the first side, you won't believe, it sounds like a Fender Rhodes." What the hell? When he said, "That's harmonics, but it's so clear, it's like magic. This guy's an unbelievable." So anyway, I lived with that album actually since then. But anyway, Miroslav said, "Well, so what are your plans?" I said, I don't know anybody. And he goes like, "Okay, well, let's make it like this." So he goes on radio, put the ad. "Oh, here's Miroslav Vitus, and, you know, I would like to tell, you know..." Actually, no. He called the radio station, and the DJ said, "Well, we just had a phone call from Miroslav Vitus that we had here in Bay. I just arrived, his friend, and he's a Czech drummer that plays with, also, you know, played with all these guys, and then he named all what, you know, and He's looking for the people to play. And I all of a sudden start getting, you know, these phone calls and get it, you know, the gigs, you know, playing, you know, jazz kind of thing, play kind of blues thing, you know, play rock, you know, with different groups, you know, and doing it.
So Vitas helped.
He really helped me to get established myself. Then later on, when I went to Los Angeles, I had, you know, started in, you know, a band already there, which was called Invisible Invisible Pedestrian. Well, what a name. I mean, you know. You're talking end of 70s, beginning of 80s, you know. I mean, Invisible Pedestrian. All right, what a name. Here we are, you know. So we got actually pretty good, you know. And, you know, we decide that we're just going to get a van and just going to go across the country and play whatever we can. So we actually...
What year is this we're talking?
This we're talking 1979. Yes. 1979. And I arrived in 1979. I arrived in New York City at the fall. The band broke up, of course, as usual.
One tour?
Yeah, yeah. That was enough. They and also, you know, that some of the guys was from Los Angeles. So, you know, they plane, you know, the red eye.
Your first U.S. tour, though.
Yeah, it was. That was the first, actually. And, you know, I actually seen the country first time. Yeah. You know, and this shit was unbelievable because I went to Grand Canyon and all that. And it was really marvelous. And after that, when I was in New York City, I said, well, you know, I'm going to find me a players to go another Invisible Pedestrian continue. And
was that your name?
Yes. I lived with that name, boy, man, you know. And everybody loved it, and everybody was like, yeah, man, that's a great name. That will sell. It never sell.
Yeah, it was sure, like, you know, right,
we should call ourselves Dumbos, man. Or
we're
like,
at the end of the second hour now, so it's the September 19th, 2008 edition of Watt from Pedro Show, end of the second hour, hold tight for hour three. September 19th, 2008, it's the third hour of the Watt from Pedro Show.
Yeah.
Watt from Pedro show. Third hour now with Yarda talking about old music days, but we played some music here. We started off with John by Estelle, Steve McKay, and myself. It's something we did last summer, maybe a year ago this month. Above a horse stable there, we had some time before the flight to the next gig, so we went with these cats. Really nice people, and jammed up some songs, and that was John. It just came out, in fact. I got an email from Bushy.
Oh, great.
And then we heard something that Yardy here played on. Now, this recording was from 1968, but in 2005, he put on the drums. And
right.
It was a band called Actual, and that song was called I Love You and Lennon. I Love You and
Lennon.
Lennon.
Yeah.
Yeah, both of you. But check its...
Milyu Tebe Alenina.
Yeah. Now, what's the story behind this Actual band?
The story, it was the most, you know, actually, that actually was the Actual. These guys play only here and there. And when they play, it was completely outrage for the government.
Ah.
Total outrage. I mean, they didn't have much of the gigs. Put it this way, really not much at all, because they couldn't, you know, when somebody wasn't in jail, then, you know, they couldn't play. Then when they went together, they couldn't play because the government would tell them, if you play, then we put you in jail again. So they were in between that and that.
Right, right.
You know, so they basically, you know, were existing for some short period of a time, and then they were, you know, then they went into different bands.
Right.
You know, and tried to live.
This song was from 68.
Right.
But you got involved to play the drums. Now, you had to put drums on this with no click track or...
Nothing. I mean, I came to the studio, you know, and he said, all right, you know, we're going to play you, you know, like, there is like 15 songs on it or something
right.
like that. We're going to play you that. And the first song, it's really straight beat, you know, and the guy is actually on it, you know, he's got little, you know, slowing in and speeding in, you know, thing. And I said, you know, I thought if I wiped all the tracks, I wouldn't have the probably the way to do it. So I kept the first one, the straight one.
Right.
And when I run into some difficulties with the changes of the rhythms, I always, you know, notice what breaks he was doing. So he either sped up or slowed down when he came out of it.
Right, right.
So I let the first one done like that, and always. But I wanted to know how it's what I'm doing wrong, that, you know, sometime, you know, the recording, you know, you went a little faster, a little slower, because the tempo, it went slower, so, you know, you have to go slower with it, but you can go slower after, you have to go at the same time.
Very tricky. We'll play some more of that. Then we heard About Them by the Ribbons, and then I was telling you about this guy, Koya, and his band, Disciplina Kičma, a Serb band from Belgrade, and Kovic Koji Ne Nosi Sat is their tune. And I got to tell you, I'm a little interested in bass players sometimes and have a bias. And this guy is a wild player. And he has a huge history going back to their scene from the late 70s through the 80s. Now he's still playing. It's a great thing, and I had a great talk with him. I wish we could have stayed. The night we played was Stooges and Dinosaur, but he played the next night with, I think, Lemonheads.
Oh, okay.
There was this gig downtown Belgrade at a thing built in the 50s for outdoor basketball. It's actually a really neat kind of venue because, I don't know, it kind of had a Greek look.
Right.
Because something about communist cement, it don't
last
long. So even though it's like 50 years old, this stuff was beat up.
Absolutely. Because, you know, you build the things that look awfully terrible.
In fact, the Greek stuff is in better shape after 2,500 years.
Absolutely, yeah.
But, you know, it was outside, the weather was great, and good sound system, and even a big screen behind us, and... Iggy was, man, Iggy's like, this is our kind of town. He was lit for the gig. Well, he is for every gig you're going to see tonight.
Yeah.
This is the first time Stooges, well, I played Czech Republic, Prague. Hmm. You know, what's this venue, a sports hall?
This is the ice hockey rink.
It's probably not the best.
No, it is good.
It is good. Most ice hockey arenas.
You'll be surprised because they have it some kind of way, figure it out, the sound, it doesn't bounce, the sound, you know, I saw it, Gypsy Kings.
Yeah.
And it was one of the most beautiful concerts, and acoustically, it was... the equipment they're gonna provide you with is the state of art.
Oh, great!
You'll see on a sound check how it is run. It really is run by the people that really know what they're doing.
Oh,
it's really
great.
Good.
So yeah, sound.
Those things are really changing here.
Back to the Yarda's music story. Now we're in New York with the invisible pedestrian.
Yeah, and here I am again. I'm trying to again go with invisible pedestrian, of course. And thinking, well, I should, you know, find a musician. So, you know, I'm hunting, right? So I'm going to the clubs for some reason, you know, I told you that I went through the, you know, I was in California, I went through the meeting, Indian meeting, I don't want to...
Powwow,
actually. And met... me sitting on my shoulder talking to me, hey you stupid, how you doing? And it was funny because he was talking English.
So
at that
Peyote
time, yeah, actually I learned that I was start dreaming in English.
Oh.
and it was already a new thing to me, you know, and so I named, you know, but the invisible pedestrian was coming from that, and I still kept the memory of the sitting dude. So, you
did
know,
did you get any help from Mr. Peyote?
Yes. All right.
That has been known to happen.
It's been known to happen.
So you're in New York with the...
I'm in New York hunting for a musician with my sort
to
of,
reform,
you know,
the band because the tour killed the last.
Right.
Version.
Yeah. The tour killed the first Invisibles. That become real pedestrian. So I was walking on the street. And believe it or not, I run into such a great musicians, like just on the street. All of a sudden, at that time I was living somewhere on the 78th Street or something like that, and on the east side, between the Madison and 5th Avenue. And right next to the museum.
Right, right.
Man. And one day... I'm going to the meeting to promote some of the recordings that we had from California, Days of Invisible Pedestrian, right? And also, you know, bringing it, the stuff, you know, that I do with Mike Hoffman and with this guy that I told you that, you know, the first, you know, band that I was in L.A. So we actually had the meeting scheduled, so I was going down to Warner Brothers and... all of a sudden, when I went to Fifth Avenue, I hear this humming, beautiful sound that surround my ears and it made me absolutely comfortable and happy. So instead of direct my ass down left to the Fifth Avenue downtown, I went of the sound, which was right on the side of the museum, where you got the fountains, right? So there is that little tiny girl playing the biggest marimba.
Oh, wow.
And she played the overtone. It was, man, I forgot completely. Meanwhile, 2 hours later, I'm still sitting there. This girl, and she plays, comes to me and goes like, it's like, you don't have to always give me a quarter, please. I mean... I know you're a musician, you know, you look like one, so don't. Now here, take this, you know. And so we started talking. I said, man, how did you get this thing in here? And said, she goes like, well, you know, I have, you know, you can, you know, dismantle it and assemble it together and it comes right to the parts. And I put it, I have this, you know, Chevy Vega and it fits through my back, you know, like put it in there, and you know, so when did you know, wait till she was packing, helped her to you know, load the car, get the phone number from her, and was thinking that gonna have to get the marimba in the band, right? So I had the first boy, maybe a member. Then I had in New York City, I had actually put it this way. After when I had Valerie, I had first member, but for some time I run into the group of people, included Lonnie Hillier, the famous trumpet player's son. His son is Lonnie Hillier too. He was a bass player, and he has a guitar player, and there was a girl, a singer. She was a Tescarero Indian, Buta Fair, and well, at that time she was Tony, going under the name Tony. So you know, her, you know, I got singing, and then I get this four piece bass, guitar, neon drums, and Papito Perez, who was a conga player from Puerto Rico, living with his rooster in the projects on the 8th Avenue around the Columbus Circle, behind the Columbus Circle. And that was the greatest thing. I went, so anyway, I played with these people.
Is it and called we did Invisible Pedestrian?
This still called... No. This name of the band was the ETC.
Etc.
And we did... I didn't... Because in that time was a band in Czech. All of a sudden, ETC. So I said, no. They would think that I stole the name from... So I said, no. I'm not going to do it. So we called ourselves an ambush.
Ambush.
I thought, well, sort of a guerrilla warfare. Okay, I call them ambush. So we call ambush. We did a bunch of gigs, and also the most important things at that time was a teleprompter. It was the cable company in Manhattan that was running actually the cable shows. You know, from that actually came the MTV. And all kinds of things. And they, the teleprompters, had a show at midnight run every Saturday. It was the new bands. And we had, because, you know, I met through the Lonnie Hillier, who was a bass player. And he was, you know, he was actually, because of his father, he was many times, all the times, basically, at the Miles' house. So,
Miles Davis.
Yes. So he was getting different, you know, different, you know, people and all, you know, like I run into the Moogie Klingman. If you remember the Moogie Klingman, the famous. So he had the old Hit Factory. Where is the Hit Factory? He had that, but only the top floor. But actually, that room stayed the same. And, it was in the process that he was making the studio out of it. So in sort of some kind of equipment, 24 truck Studer plus some three boards, we put together, he assembled together the recording facility that we record live about 7 songs. And we filmed it at the same time we done it by the teleprompter. So it went on the Saturday on the television. And Alice was recording in Media Sound on the near the Central Park was the studio Media Sound, which it was actually old church. It was it used to be, because they still had the bar, you know, the sitting, the benches,
pews.
And, yeah, the pews, and it was a beautiful place. But anyway, Alice is there recording, and with Dick Wagner and Prakash John and with, you know, whatever, you know. And I think it was his, that comes to the 88 time, 89. And we are in New York, and we had another tour in front of us. We said, okay, we do it. So we went across the states again. It was a fast tour. It only took, I believe it was like 6 months we did. And we landed again in Los Angeles. And so we got there that we shopped for a real, real record company. We got Atlantic Records to interest in. We got really good lawyers. I have to admit that I had pretty good connections from, you know, people like Miroslav and Jan, you know. So he gave me, you know, names, and those names, you know, opened the doors to another names. And I went through, you know, like... Then I went, you know, met Tom Petty, you know, and, you know, I got into more people, and I met Pygmy Love Circus, and, you know, all of it, Savage, and, you know, Shepherd, and everybody, and Danny playing those days, which is now he's in Tool, right? Oh, he's, you know that he did the tour with the Pygmies?
No, I didn't know.
Yeah. That. I just was talking, to somebody, a roadie, he's living actually in Prague, and he knows them very well. Tony, I think his name. And he did the Pygmy Love Circus from the beginning. And he said, Danny's doing the tour.
Wow.
That was last year. So, anyway, we had pretty interest. Now, we rehearse in the studios in Hollywood. La Cienega Studios, that was on La Cienega, down below the sunset.
West Hollywood.
Yeah, no.
It was Hollywood.
It was, yeah. Just low, you know, like... So anyway, we rehearsing in this facility, getting organized, getting for the big day. Finally, the label said, yeah, okay. Give you the money, go to Paramount Studio, cut 4 songs. So we cut 4 songs with Dick Wagner, doing the engineering, doing the producing. We give it to them, they liked it. So he said, all right, let's have we come into the rehearsal, and we're gonna bring the contract. We're gonna get little celebration in there. So they did the catering. And me and lead singers is there. We had 5 o'clock to start. Now the record company, of course, comes 5:15. You know, like little after, of course. And supposedly we were ready to play. There's no bass player, there's no guitar player. Our bass. I'm trying to smooth the corners, you know what I mean? I'm going like, let's get some booze, come on, you know. So we tried all the, you know, people looking, where is the band's gonna play? Or, you know, where's the rest of it? And I go, yeah, well, they traffic, you know, I mean, bad, you know, that's terrible. And he lived in North Hollywood in that time, so it's the other side of the
valley.
And then, so, you know, I tried, I lied, oh God, man, I tried through everything to have them stay. Meanwhile, through doing this, bring the phone at the desk, you know, at the studio, guy goes, hey, Yarda, you got the call. So I'm going, hello, there's a guitar player. I go, man. Where are you? The whole company is here standing. And he goes like, well, we didn't want to with Racine tell you that, but, you know, our girlfriends was leaving us, so I'm actually calling you from New York because we took the flight at 10 o'clock in the morning. Bam! Baboo! Everything is in a blueberry hill, you know, in that point. So I'm going like, well, you know, let's set another day, you know, all right? And so everybody leaves, man, you know. Go home and go like, what am I gonna do? Meanwhile, there's a fear playing.
Yeah.
So, one of the concerts that we played before this happened, I think a week before there, we played, you know, in some kind of lounge. It was a club on Sunset Boulevard, Paradise Lounge, or something
lingerie.
Like that. Yeah, something.
The lingerie.
It was a pretty big rock club anyway. Okay. So we played there, and we opened for Fear.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I just played with Lee.
And we just finished, and there comes Derv.
Yeah,
Fred.
Derv Scratch.
Yeah. There comes Derv, yeah. And it goes, "Hey, man. Would you like to be in my band, Scratch?"
Yeah, right.
And I go, "Yeah, sure." So I recorded with Scratch. Actually, you know, I should have bring. I have only vinyl, but it was released. It was released on. Not sure anymore what label it is.
So you're playing with them.
But yeah, I'm on
but
it.
But you get back to San Francisco.
Yeah, well, that's this. So I'm playing with Scratch.
Right.
Right? Till the moment that Turf it's Cosa Nostra. I would say. So it's ballooning. Not much gigs going on yet. If there's a gig, then there's always a big, big, big rodeo, you know? And club owners start being like really pissy about the thing, you know. So anyway, it come to the point that somewhere around the neighborhood of 1990, we finished, right?
Yeah.
And I thought, what am I gonna do? Then this guy comes and go, "Hey, look. I got these great musicians in California, in San Francisco." I was in California, LA. I've been in San Francisco. "Let's go there." He had a van, I put my drums in it, we put the equipment, and I just left myself LA, went to San Francisco. Went to San Francisco. They were in Santa Rosa living, up above the San Francisco. So, there was a rehearsal place there too, you know. It was nice people. The guy who I was playing with, and his name was a Bobby Guitar Lindstrom. That was his name going on. Pretty good guitar player, pretty good singer. We got a great bass player who's been doing, working, you know, with Vince Velnick in those days. And I have guests. Vince now is already gone.
Yeah.
But he was very big guest with us. You know, he sat in, you know, many, many times, you know, did even recording. And Stu Blank.
Oh, yeah.
The Stu Blank. I have a recording with old Stu Blank. God, what an organ player that was. So, we were just playing like this, you know, for being in there. And then I playing a gig with Michael Mann. He was the big, big guy. You remember him, Michael. Mickey, there was a two English guy. Michael was the big guy, and he was actually from the, what band was that? English band, very famous band. Anyway, so, you know, my remembrance, it's actually after yesterday, it's not that happening. The names, it's sort of, you know, in a back file.
Okay. But so somehow you get playing with Della.
Well, no, coming to it.
Okay.
Michael is here.
The show.
We playing in that gig, and he goes like, "I know he's got this dude, keyboard player, come on and play with us one gig." So I'm playing with this guy, keyboard player, who goes like, "Where do you live?" "I live in Santa Rosa." I go, and he goes like, "You can't live in Santa Rosa. Come on, you're going to go and live in San Francisco." So I start living in old famous Orange House, that actually through the Orange House went all the musicians. There were Bouncing Souls. There were actually, you know, there were coming the Kids. Actually before he got Chris Cornell.
when before he got famous, there were all Seattle bands were like coming in and sleep, play, and you know, from wherever, from Texas, you know, the Rhythm Picks, from you know, Waco. Yeah, it was really good. I mean,
Carlos Guitaro.
Yeah,
he's a friend of mine.
And so you know, in that house, yeah. I basically you know get together a band that we call it Orange Orange. We called ourselves, and I had a bass player, first member of the Life After Life, first member, and. On that, you know, we're still Orange Orange. We got a guitar player, David, which is, he is Dave Perkins. He's fantastic. He did a record now with Tom Waits. But he's got the funky band called Stiff Dead Cat, which actually was assembled after the Life After Life. We got so drunk in some parts that we couldn't play anything than bluegrass. And we played it so good. We played real good. So, there was two beginning members of the Life After Life. Then I got the accordion guy, which in New York City a long time ago, a guy told me, you're gonna play and make a greatest band of them all with this accordion player. And I said, I hate accordion. I never play with accordion. Now, anyway, come San Francisco, I'm sitting in 20 Tanks, which it was a brewery right across from the Slims.
Yeah.
I'm sitting right there drinking a beer, and there's a guy across the room, the big room, sitting by the window and looking at me. I'm looking at him. And in New York, all of a sudden, I remember the guy that told me that I'm going to meet somebody. That guy all of a sudden stand up, come into my table and said, you are Erno, right? I said, yeah, I'm Erno. And he goes like, well, my name is Jim Chert. And I go, oh, this is the guy that you were playing accordion. And he goes, yeah. I said, ah, where are you playing? And he goes, I play in a bar. That was a place, you know, on Valencia. And so, you know, I went there, small little pub. And he played by himself. God, when I heard that stuff, he is amazing. He is such a player that it's incredible. So I thought, dude, do you want to get a band around you? And he said, well, I will try. I said, okay, let's have a rehearsal and let's do that. So I got a guitar player, bass player, the keyboard player who got that I got living, who has the orange house that I played with Michael that I got into. I asked him to join the band. He never played in any rock and roll bands. He only played blues. That's Andy. Andy Pollock.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So Andy became a keyboard player. And we went to the rehearsal. We did with the accordion. We clicked. I mean, instant click. And I have, in that time, I have two mics, really good. EV50s, you know, one of those really great mics, and I get a DAT machine. I have a board, and I made a recording demo with 10 songs on it in our rehearsal room. And I did that, and I went to what was that place? Chameleon on the also in Valencia. That was another club.
Chameleon, and, right?
Yeah. So I went there, and Biafra was supposed to be there looking for a band, signed out some guys that he seen them in Gilman, and he liked them, and they played the Chameleon, so, yeah, all right. So when I heard that, I thought, my time. So I took the cassette, went there, and he was talking on the bar with somebody, and I literally move myself, you know, muscle myself onto it and, you know, go like, hello, my name's Yarga. And he goes like, yes, Joel. And I said, yeah, I know. I said, do you got to sign this band for Alternative Tentacles? Because I'm telling you, I said,
Who are you telling me what I'm going to sign? Don't you see I'm talking right here? You know, it's like, you know, come on. And I go like, I'm telling you your big mistake. This is it. So, anyway, I literally gave him the cassette because I know that he doesn't like the CDs and he doesn't like the decks. He only liked the cassettes or the vinyl. That's it. So, in those days, so I got it on the cassette, gave it to him. He looked at it. Anyway, put it in the pocket. Few days passed. It's calling me a friend of mine, Chris McKay, which plays with band Helios Creed.
Yeah.
Right?
Guitarist.
So the Helio, actually very good friend of mine.
Yeah, good guy.
So they playing in Europe and they in Prague. This is, we talking 1995. Right, 95. And we are, they go, we are in Prague, we met some friend of yours, and yeah, and I go, Chris, yeah, that's fantastic, and you know, I met this guy, used to smoke a weed, and so I all blah blah over the phone, but anyway, he goes like, yo, why I'm calling, we had a gig at the Paradise Lounge, and we're gonna be playing there, and we want you for the opening band. So I said, okay. So we go and, you know, right across from Slim's Room,
yeah,
Paradise Lounge.
Yeah.
So yeah, we play there. So we opening for them. And man, we are stuck in the lounge because the Helio put everything on a big stage and said, you'll have a lot of stuff. And said, nothing's gonna be moved. You guys are in a lounge. So we are in a lounge. Then comes Biafra. They break his knee,
yeah,
at Gilman because they saw that, yeah, they saw that he was, that was about those days with the Levi's shit that was going on, the commercials, and they saw that he did sign that. So it was like, you know, really outrage. Anyway, so this happened, he comes with the on crutches, you know, sit down, man, and then here we are, all band, here's Jello, man. Something must have happened. He listened our stuff. Right? He did listen our stuff. He came in. Absolutely enjoyed the show. I only remember the owner of a Paradise Lounge running around with the meter. We create 125 decibels in the lounge.
Wow.
I mean, we were so loud. And he loved it. We were absolutely marvelous. Oh yeah, we add to that JT from Rhythm Pigs. JT, John Terry, he called himself a Schmecky LaVey. Oh God. So anyway, so we add that guy. So we are actually a six-piece band and we create such a noise and the songs. He was moving. We finished the playing and Jello goes, okay guys, nothing to be talking about. We cut in the record for the Alternative Tentacles and we're gonna sign the contract. We're gonna make them, we're gonna sign them. Alright, that's it.
Wow.
And we went, cut the record went out, you know, we went on a road. We were really big and you know, it's like, it was actually, it's still the one of the favorite bands of Jello. It was the times that from 95 to 97, wherever he were talking about anything, you are Life After Life. That's the band. You gotta hear that. He was like Mad Celts marching across
the
America.
Did you meet Steve around this time?
No, it was later. A little later.
Oh.
I'm coming to... That's...
There's 5 minutes left in the show.
There's 5 minutes left? Okay, make it story really quick. Now... Now I'm proceeding. Moms of a lead singer, the accordion guy got sick. He has to go back to Prague. He went to the Prague. Band basically broke up. We did the record without him, with Jello, for the Twisted Willie.
which is the Willie Nelson album, which we did it, you know, with Jello. He's still moving to me song, and there's a bunch of other people, Highwaymen and everything. I had chance to meet, you know, all these beautiful people. But anyway, there was a reality. We tried to get another man to replace the accordion guy. Didn't happen. So we took a trip to Prague, played in Prague for 6 months in around the Europe, went back to America and said, okay, fuck this, we're not gonna do that, we're gonna get another singer, we're gonna try it again. Then we got the Stiff Dead Cat and all that, everything. With Joe, we were going to work on another album. He was really mad at Jim, you know, that he left, and he, you know, some of it's, it was really bad story. But anyway, we still, you know, like, you know, are selling like crazy after 11 years, the Life After Life, and we still have it's, you know, on Apple pages. When you got it, you will find that, you know, I just read the last year we got 5 stars out of 5 possible stars. I couldn't believe it. For 11 years non-stop, it didn't stop. And you know, that's, I think, you know, that's pretty good for the album like that. So I went back, and I met Camille, because Camille used to come in, you know, days on the Hate Street when I was living. He used to come over there, and we were jamming together. We got, you know, the things going together. We got recording some together. We went to Joshua Tree, that he had the you know, trailer house. Yeah. So we did that, and with the people from the the Earthlings, and they actually are the queens of the Stone Age.
Yeah,
right. So those guys, gosh. Yeah, so with these guys we were living, actually, you know, they let us record it in their studio in there, and we did that, the recording, as you remember, only the drums and bass, with Camille's girlfriend playing the guitar.
Right.
And then, you know, many, many, many people who comes from, you know, either from, you know, the Queens, or, you know, from anybody, Masters of Reality, you know, it's like everybody who was there, who came in the house, it just did some banging or did something on the recording. And we actually used some of it, you know, Camille fixed it up together, and we start playing around, and then I run into the Steven.
Yeah.
In one of the days, you know, we played together, we did the show.
Well, you then we got to live by him. You happen to live by him?
Yeah.
We didn't know each other then, but he'd been living by me for quite some time.
But we didn't, absolutely. All of a sudden,
he
then
says,
it comes
me,
like,
pick
yes.
Pick me up in my house, it's the orange house, isn't it?
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you know, we seen each other, because, you know, later on, you know, I knew the face, you know, and everything. And I was like, God, this is living right there, where we were living. So we started playing the gigs. We did, you know, the radio. We did, you know, other stuffs. And then we got, you know, Camille again traveling, you know, down the Joshua Tree, and I didn't want it to do it, you know, so I went basically to New York City, played there for a little while, and then I decided, he told me that I could put this band together with, like, famous people in Prague, so I went to Prague.
You went back home.
And went back
after
home.
After all these years.
After all these years, and here I am. But I'll go... You know, I don't know how long I'm gonna be here, you know, tell you the truth, you know, the way things goes, and, you know, it could be alright, because I like, now, with Julie, I have, you know, that thing that you heard yesterday,
yeah,
you mentioned, you know, so, things, you know, I have, actually, now, I will let her sing too, and I will, you know, again, get and gather some more musicians, and I have some help coming from States. I have some of the Life After Life people who would like to play with me, and I already have them last year few, and they start liking it, and they come in back, and they stay in it, because it's great living, you know, I mean, you got pretty good, you know, but right. The scenery, it's more, rather not talk about.
Yarda, if somebody was to ask you for advice about music, what would you tell them?
I'll follow your heart. That's what I would say. Don't mess around with any offers that will only just clog hamburgers your mouth for some period of a time and then zilch. And even furthermore, those that they really like you would not really much like you anymore because you're just cheapo, you know? Like, you know, that's why I'm really so much like dudes like Jello that sticks to the real thing, or, you know, you guys. You know what I mean? It's, I think, just follow your heart. Don't make wide business. I mean, what's the business nowadays? Record companies, they don't even sell anymore anything. You can download it anything you want. So why you need a record company? Make your own. Yeah. This is the 21st century. For God's sake, we live in a life of possibility. It's a garage time.
Yeah.
Any band can create their own show. You know, it's like, it's Wayne's World. Put it on the net, man. You got some people watching it. And if you're good, you bet you're gonna get it. And if you put some recording down, people download it, you'll be on.
Oh, great. I want to thank you for being on the show. Very interesting journey through the music world. And thank you for sharing it with all of us.
Thank you, Mike.
And the greatest luck.
All right.
Brother.
Thanks, dude. All right, Steve. Thank you.
Coming aboard. This has been the September 19th, 2008 Watt from Pedro show.
And to everybody, hello, and hi, and I'll be back in stage. Definitely doing some things.
Keep your powder dry.